Good morning. My name is Linda Alley, and I serve as the coordinator for School for Leadership Training each year. On behalf of Eastern Mennonite Seminary and all those who have planned this event, I welcome you. You all are an answer to our prayers for your safe arrival and for good weather to bring you here, and we're very happy that you've come with us. This year's school was planned cooperatively with the seminary, with the EMU Business Department, with MEDA, and with Everence Financial. As co-sponsors of the event, Everence provided a pre-conference training session yesterday. How many of you were able to attend there? If you received a full or a partial scholarship, or if you received a $25 discount if you registered as a couple or as a group, you might want to stop at the Everence display in the hallway and thank them personally for that. And now I'd like to invite Seminary Dean Michael King to once again introduce Dr. Brueggemann for us.
Some of you will have heard this introduction yesterday evening, but for those of you who are here for the first time, we welcome you. And I'll review again some of the reasons why we invited Dr. Walter Brueggemann here to be among us. He is a retired Old Testament scholar, prolific author, and professor emeritus at Columbia Theological Seminary. He's an advocate and practitioner of rhetorical criticism. He has written more than 58 books, hundreds of articles, and several commentaries on books of the Bible. He's also a minister in the United Church of Christ. Ask him, I won't comment on it now, ask him what UCC stands for. He offered some interesting perspectives yesterday evening to a few of us privately. Brueggemann has a PhD from Union Theological Seminary, New York, and a PhD from St. Louis University. Recent books include Disruptive Grace, Reflections on God, Scripture, and the Church, Journey to the Common Good, and Out of Babylon. And as our faculty member who is here this morning, I believe Mark Thiessen Nation, has noted, Brueggemann has devoted his life to a passionate exploration of Old Testament theology with an emphasis on the relation between the Old Testament and the Christian canonical works. If you were hearing Walter's presentation last night, you heard the fruits of that, the origins and history of Christian doctrine, and the dynamics of Jewish-Christian interactions. Brueggemann has been called a postmodern scholar, and he is married to Tia Ann Brueggemann and has two sons, James and John, and five grandchildren. Those of us who were privileged to experience Walter last night know that only begins to cover the richness of what he is here to offer us, but that at least gives a few of the details. Linda Alley, the boss of me here, are we moving straight from this into talkback, or are we taking a break now? So at this point, we are ready for the talkback? Okay. We are going to welcome all of you to exactly that, a talkback. Now, I discussed with Walter this morning that we don't know how many of you maybe are here hearing Walter for the first time, so we want to take that into account, and we do welcome you. And also, as those of you who were here last evening would have noted, Walter was very shy. He was he was unwilling to tell us his perspectives, and so we gain very little understanding of what he really believes about things. So to meet both of those needs, he has graciously agreed to try to be a little clearer for about 5 minutes and give a bit of a recap of the kinds of concerns that you may want to talk back to. And so I invite you now, Walter, to do precisely that. I know we're Mennonites, but we can take it.
About the UCC, the dean said to me last night at dinner, you people are a little liberal, aren't you? And I told him what he was referring to, that at Yale, they say UCC means unbelievers considering Christ. So we do that very often. Well, it's wonderful to get to be with you. As we were singing, I thought about that vision at the end of the Bible about the 144 saints surrounding the throne in perpetual praise. And I've often thought that would be a long time to praise. But you were probably like me this morning. You didn't want the singing to stop. And perpetual would be all right. And I was deeply moved by the way you did the parable. And thank you for that. So I'm just very grateful to get to be with you. I assume that those of you that were there last night have thought of nothing except what I talked about since last night. But in case you don't remember, what I tried to do was to tell the biblical story of greed, for which Pharaoh in the book of Exodus is the paradigmatic figure. And as you may know, historical critics have spent a great deal of energy trying to figure out which Pharaoh that is. Some people think it's Ramses II, and some people think it's Merneptah, and there are a number of candidates. There's a very good reason that the Bible does not tell us which Pharaoh it is, because it's always the Pharaoh that's in front of us. He is a paradigm, and what the Bible knows is that the story of Pharaoh keeps being reenacted, always in contemporary form, which always leaves the question for the faithful about whether it is possible to depart the regime of Pharaoh. And it seems to me that's the great question among us now. So tonight I'm going to talk about the departure, etc. So we have some time for you to have your say about question or comment or alternative proposal. And here we go.
I can just add a few words, Walter, of logistics. We do have a completely full auditorium, and we would really appreciate your coming to the microphones. Walter told me the story of some situation you were at where somebody insisted on leading the Q&A, which I am not going to do, but this person did, and persistently, and I think annoyingly, repeated the questions, and one way that we can avoid repeating the questions is if you make sure to use microphones. The other comment would be if you could name who you are on the way to asking a question or talking back. And finally, I want to correct myself. In addition to loving those of you who are UCC, I do love Mennonites. I come from that stream myself. But there are many, many traditions represented here today. One of my learnings when I became dean at Eastern Mennonite Seminary was that we are richly ecumenical. The seminary itself is only about half Mennonite, about a fifth Methodist, and then a whole range of other traditions, including UCC. And then we have a whole other range of folks here from all kinds of walks of life, from business leaders through Eastern Mennonite University and beyond. So I think we will have enough perspectives here to engage you richly and meaningfully. So Walter is going to take it from here, and now it's your time to talk back.
Speaking of being ecumenical, I did some presentations at Augsburg Seminary in Minneapolis last year, and the president, in welcoming people, said this is a very ecumenical gathering. We have people from St. Olaf College, and we have people from Concordia College. Well, he told me later the reason that's ecumenical is there were Swedish Lutherans and Norwegian Lutherans and German Lutherans. That's very ecumenical. Sir.
Mike Strathke, I work with Mennonite Foundation of Canada in Kitchener, Ontario, Canada. Thank you for your presentation last evening. I was very taken by your suggestion that Jesus was referring to Solomon in the parable of the rich fool. I found it both helpful, provocative, and troubling. And I was wondering if you could say a bit more on that, specifically because if we use a slightly different lens and are looking at different parts of the Old Testament, one might say that Solomon was generous and rich toward God. And it maybe speaks to the underlie of not what you do with your wealth, but how you got it. So I'm wondering if you could, you know, speak to those conflicts that I'm having as I consider those.
So you're asking about that portrayal of Solomon?
Absolutely, please. Yeah.
My own judgment, which of course is open to discussion, is that the narrative of Solomon in 1 Kings is profoundly ironic. And if you read it straightforwardly without irony, you get a nice little Sunday school lesson. But the Bible requires us to do harder work than that. And therefore, I think that Solomon's wisdom in 1 Kings is portrayed ironically as great foolishness. So as you know, the Solomonic regime ends in a tax revolt around Rehoboam in 1 Kings 12. And the tax revolt, just like the Tea Party movement, is that peasants are tired of sending their tax money to the top of the pyramid for the self-indulgence of the people at the top of the pyramid. So I think that Solomon's temple, which I assume you would take to be his gesture of rich toward God, is really a huge gesture of self-congratulations that is essentially contradictory to the character of God. So as I said last night, all this gold, 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 it's an exhibit of Solomon's splendor and influence and I suppose virility. That's what the 700 concubines are all about. And I think for the alert reader, it's designed to mock Solomon as a guy who got it wrong. Now, so everything turns on the question of whether it's ironic. I think that once you see the irony in it, you can hardly go back to pre-ironic innocence. That's my own thinking about it. And I don't think we've done a good job of helping people in the church read the Bible past our initial innocence. I think we are incredibly innocent, and I think that the Bible itself is much wiser than that. So that's my take on it. Yeah.
Dr. Gerbigan, Pastor Bob Petersheim from Conestoga Mennonite. My question builds on that a bit. Your voice is obviously fits in the biblical tradition of the prophet, clear and direct towards powers. In the Old Testament, obviously, that was the Holy Spirit falling on one individual primarily. My question in the New Testament, since Pentecost empowering the body, would you see primarily that the prophetic voice yet in the New Testament remains that task of individuals or the corporate body, and if the corporate body, can you point to how that's done well without muting the prophetic by the kind of pastoral concerns of those in the body? How is it?
Say a little more about the last part about muting.
It seems to me we don't do well yet at empowering the prophetic voices, because we try to please the corporate body. I think we have to speak as a corporate body, wondering what you might say as to how we might recapture an empowered prophetic voice.
I'm no New Testament scholar, but I think that the book of Acts is the unleashing of the church in the empire. And they obviously depended on apostolic leadership, and the leaders are the ones that are called to trial before the empire, but it obviously is the whole community that is bearing witness to Easter, which is the most radical subversion of the empire. My hunch about empowering the body is that the access point is pain. And I don't know, I don't think Mennonites do that, but very much the church is a feel-good society, and we're all supposed to come together on Sunday morning and be happy and say God is good and whatnot. And, but the pain is palpable, and we have to help people think about the systemic ground of pain and what is producing this. Because I think when people get in touch with truth-telling about pain, it unleashes our courage for truth-telling about the pain of the world and the pain of the brothers and the sisters. So I believe that the pastoral task is to break the cocoon of denial that our culture wants us to practice. And once that cocoon of denial is broken and truth becomes the language that we try to speak, then I think it's possible to tell the truth about many things in our system of death in the world. I don't think it's easy to get there because a lot of us have a huge stake in denial because we are afraid that if we go into it, it's all going to fall apart on us. When I started my many years of psychotherapy, after about 6 weeks, my pastoral counselor said, do you want to start talking about something important or you just want to keep doing this? And and a lot of the time we want to just keep doing this. That's what I think.
Dr. Brueggemann, I'm Gordon Merriweather. I'm one of those Methodist refugees that Michael talked about earlier. I was intrigued with your systemic comments last night and the model you laid before us in the narrative of accumulation, leading to monopoly, leading to violence. And I guess I need some further clarification. We're accumulating at the top. The rich get richer. More powerful get more powerful. The middle class vanishes, diminishes, or becomes part of the either or, the top or the bottom. The bottom gets poorer and continually strives for more, to get more and more and pull themselves out of the poverty. In the end game, it all leads to violence, anxiety, all the things you talked about last night. I guess I missed it, and maybe it's my Methodism that's and the systemic approach we seem to take to everything. I'm trying to figure out how you break that cycle, how you break that narrative, and I didn't hear that answer last night.
Really? Well, there is no, obviously there is no easy answer. I have been much instructed of late by Peter Block. Do you know Peter Block? If you do not, I commend him to you. He is a Jewish community advocate who lives in Cincinnati, where I live. And his great theory about community power is that communities have the resources they need to bring health without bureaucracy and expertise. And therefore, a community organization or the commonality of effort and energy from those who are disadvantaged and excluded, and the generation of political will to be saying, this is not right. But what's going on is that the Tea Party and things like that, that are funded from the top, persuade powerless people to sign on to the interest of the people at the top. And therefore, what has to happen is that people who are left out at the bottom, as you describe them, have to recognize that our interest is not allied with the interest at the people of the top, and we have a different agenda and a different need and different resources. So that if Easter resurrection were proclaimed as a political reality, the energy of life, it is promised, could defeat the power of systemic death in our world. So what has to happen pastorally is to break the collusion that is underway in our society between the people at the top and the people at the bottom who keep identifying with the people at the top. Am I making any sense to you? That's what I think. And I think that the Exodus narrative is paradigmatic, because what the burning bush articulated to Moses is that the slaves do not have any vested interest in keeping Pharaoh's system functioning. And so they have to divest of their loyalty to Pharaoh's system in order to participate in another stream of history. Now, let me tell you how I think that comes to play in a local congregation. I did some weeks of study in my local congregation where I worship on the book of Daniel, which I had never done before, and I tried to make the case about maintaining Jewish identity in Nebuchadnezzar's empire. That's sort of how I set it up. And at the end of it, this nice old man who is obviously very affluent and doesn't get it said to me, he said, you know, I'm as old as you are. I'm 80 years old. And he said, I have never felt the pressure of the empire in my life. And I said, duh. So we are brainwashed into not Mennonites, but the rest of us. We are brainwashed into not noticing the pressure of the empire because we believe that the empire is an ontological given. And what people have to be helped to see is that it's a social construct. That's all it is. It's a social construct that depends on car ads and beer ads and patriotic speeches. I couldn't believe it. I was sitting on the Delta plane yesterday in Atlanta, and before we took off, and I was wondering, what would a Mennonite do? The pilot came on and said, we have some servicemen with us. Let's all give them a big hand. And we all clapped for the military. For God's sake, what are we doing? Well, what we assumed on the Delta airline, which is owned by the people at the top of the pyramid, is that the American military keeps the ontological givenness of the capitalist system in place. And here comes these feeble little church communities to say, it's not so. It's not a given in your life. It's a social construct. You don't owe it anything, and you don't have to participate in it. Am I making any sense to you? Uh-huh. Which is why, you know, preaching and that sort of thing is so difficult. Because who wants to hear that? Or who wants to say that? But the book of Acts really is bearing witness to the claim that the Roman Empire is not the carrier of truth. So, page after page, the apostles appear before the Roman governors, and the Roman governor said, "Did you really say that?" And they say, "Yes." Now, if you want to go back to the microphone and respond to that, I'd be glad to have you do that. I have come to think that the expose of what we think is an ontological given to be a social construct is the most important pastoral work. It's the same thing in pastoral care. What my pastoral counselor helped me see, that my self-identity was not an ontological given, it was a social construct given to me by my mother. Blessed be her name. Go ahead.
It seems to me that the difficulty in the masses understanding the model you've portrayed is our lack of, the lack of faith in the community. And we're dealing, as preachers, we're going to be dealing with people that want to be in that church, more or less. They're not really the problem. They're the minor problem, I think. The bigger problem are those, you know, I'm a retired naval officer.
Retired what?
Naval officer.
Okay.
And every time I get on the plane and they applaud for the military or do whatever, I shake my head. When we came back from Vietnam, there was no shaking the head.
Yeah.
And I just look at these people who are sending young men and women to die have put themselves above all that.
Right.
They are the power base. They are between the top and the bottom.
Yep.
I'm still concerned as a minister, and hopefully, Michael, you guys will teach me before I get out of this place, how to get to those folks, how to get the people that aren't there, the unchurched, my children that don't go to church, the people that know, the 90% yep. of the community that knows Christianity,
yep.
and we can't get to. That model worries me because exactly what you said. The Tea Partiers, the others, are going to be pushing down and pushing yep. down and pushing down yep. and bringing those people that ought to know better
yep.
into their fold to well, support it's, the empire.
It's long odds. It's been long odds since Paul bore witness in the Roman Empire.
This is not a new problem?
It's not a new problem. But I believe that there is a kind of a ambivalent readiness in our society, because increasing numbers of people know that the imperial narrative has failed. And there is a kind of an asking about whether anybody has got a better narrative. So, on the one hand, I want to find out whether there's a better narrative. On the other hand, don't tell me. And I think that pastoral work is exactly at that point of ambivalence. That's what I think.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
My name is Jeremy Yoder. I'm pastor at Emmanuel Mennonite Church in La Junta, Colorado. And I pastor in a marginal community. We are a rural community. We are one of the poorest counties in Colorado. It's been in a downward slide for the past 50 years. And so there's a lot of struggle right now. And being a young new pastor, one of the questions I've been asking myself is, what's the role of the church in economic development? And I went and had a very depressing conversation with the development office in one of the neighboring towns. And development right now is about attracting businesses from other places by giving them enough incentives to move to you. And so instead of creating something new, we're just playing shuffleboard. So the question I have is, I appreciate your systematic critique, and I agree with it. But systematic critique doesn't put food on the table and doesn't keep the lights on. We are struggling for survival as a community on such fundamental things like water rights. And the community has recently fought off military plans to expand the Pinyon Canyon proving grounds to take over southeastern Colorado and destroy the ranching industry and the towns, basically. So I guess part of my question then is, we don't just need a better system. We need jobs in the imperfect system that we have now. And how do we, as a community of faith, live faithfully in an unjust system?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, and you're the one that would know the answer to how that happens in your community. But I think it has to do with the mobilizing of political energy to open the system so that the resources of the pyramid are shared. And I would think that that would call for churches in your kind of disadvantaged environment to find allies in churches in better circumstance. So that political will has to do with bringing brothers and sisters together and pooling political energy and political will and political resources to insist that the system open up, because there are enough resources in Colorado to deal with this, with access to federal resources, but it requires political will that has to reach beyond your disadvantaged community. That's how my mind operates about it. But you know more about it than I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Samantha Leo. I'm a pastor in Allentown, Pennsylvania area, Mennonite Church. You talked last night about the spiritual attraction of money, and that it draws our deepest loyalties. And I'd love to hear you speak a little more about analyzing the spiritual authority of money. Because you said no one wants to hear that, or no one, you know, I think like we do want to hear a different narrative, like you're saying, people are asking for that. And there is a spiritual attraction to the gospel, right, or to that other way of being in the world. So, you also mentioned liturgies of money. I just would like to hear you talk a little bit more about those things and how, and the alternative liturgies, I mean, which we know about and we try to use, but I don't know how to strengthen those, or, just to talk a little more about those, the contrasts between the spiritual attraction of money and of the things that we really want to be attracted to.
Well, I think that the liturgies of military capitalism on television are all about youth and beauty and success and well-being. But what you notice in a beer ad, no one ever talks about anything important. In fact, mostly no one ever says anything. They just all grin. Or, for the most part, sitcoms are now a series of mean-spirited put-downs of each other, etc., etc., etc. And it is a model for how social power ought to be organized. And it is a model for death, because you cannot live that way. Nobody lives that way. But our kids are seduced into thinking, I ought to live that way. It's the normative way to live. And then you get peer pressure and all of that. So I don't know the ways to strengthen the liturgy, except that we must be more truth-telling about the deathliness of the normative system. And we not only offer an alternative, but we have to expose the reality that what's on offer here has no contact
with the bodily reality of our daily lives. It's simply not like that. And clearly young women who get anorexia have bought in on all those skinny, sad-faced models of thinking, I ought to look like that, etc., etc., etc. And we all know better than that, except that we'd like to participate in that. So if you're old, if you're an old guy sitting at home alone without any social connections, God, you think it'd be great to have a beer with these four handsome guys like that, and so on and so on. So we have to truth tell as we are telling hope. We have to be telling truth about the illusionary world that is constructed through military capitalism, in which the media are in total collusion. That's not a new insight, but it's a really important insight. You want to come back at that?
Well, it just struck me as the previous conversation about these folks who we can't reach, and I was just thinking, we are these people. I mean, we are all seduced by it, and I guess telling people that they need to, we have a lot to lose, a lot of us have a lot to lose if we really believe that the empire's narrative has failed, because we really have bought into it.
We do have a lot to lose. So Peter says, where is it, Mark 10, we have left everything and followed you, for God's sake.
So that's the part where it's like, how do you get the good news into that? You know, because I want to tell them you should lose the things you need that you have to lose. But
well, and obviously the evangelical answer to that is having a viable community of brothers and sisters is more life-giving than houses and cars. But I don't believe that. I only believe that on a very good day at church camp. But pastor says to me, well, it's true whether you happen to believe it or not. It's true. That it seems to me, is the place where you are. But that's where the church always is in the empire. Yeah. It's just that right now, the contradiction between gospel and empire is so highly visible for anybody that looks.
I hope.
And that ought to be a time that gives us openings for our claims of an alternative. That's what I think.
I hope so.
Yeah. I belong to a suburban church that's got a really good youth program. And they do mission trips and they do all sorts of manner of thing. And my pastor says, he said, I don't expect people to come to our church, but who wouldn't want their kids in our missional program where they learn what it's like to be a healthy human being? That seems to be just about right. That the bid is for a healthy humanness that will never arise from the story of the empire. And all these people that drop their kids off at church have a hunch about that. They couldn't articulate it, but they have a hunch about it.
Dr. Brueggemann, my name is Paul Stutzman. I'm a brother and minister, and I serve as an interim pastor in the Disciples of Christ Church in Boones Mill, Virginia. I very much appreciated your words last night. You made a brief comment in passing. I think it was when you were talking about Daniel, and something along the lines of, it's fiction, these are just stories. And then you went on, and I didn't really understand you there.
What didn't you understand?
Well,
that was a strategic maneuver. In a couple of weeks, I'm doing a clergy conference for my Episcopal diocese in Cincinnati. And I talked to the bishop recently, and he said, I have many priests who are coming to think that the gospel story is a fairy tale. Can you help us? And what I'm going to argue about fiction is that the narrative of military capitalism is the fairy tale. So the gospel is fiction judged by the norms of the empire. It's kind of a silliness about a resurrection, for God's sake. But from the gospel narrative, the claims of empire to make us safe and happy are a pure fairy tale. Now, the only reason I said that about Daniel, I just wanted you to know that I'm a really good historical critic, and no historical critic believes that the stories in Daniel are factual historicity. So I just thought I'd acknowledge that.
Thank you.
So, but if you can establish that the narrative of military capitalism is a fairy tale, then at least we have a level playing field that my fiction is truer than your fiction. That's what I meant. By introducing the category of fiction, I was looking down the road to make the case, as best I could, that the claims of the empire are pure fiction. The claims of Mitt Romney's entrepreneurial society are pure fiction unless you are born as a son of a multimillionaire. And then I can start three businesses too. That's no big problem. But the bailout gives the lie to the narrative of military capitalism. So we ought to crowd that story and make the case that we have a better narrative. But you see, judged from the epistemology of the empire, all that stuff in the Bible is nonsense. So shift the ground from over here, that's nonsense. And if you say fiction versus fiction, that ought to put people in epistemological crisis. And my experience is that most pastors want to protect church people from an epistemological crisis. So you really hope people don't understand what we're saying. That's what I think. You want to come back at that?
No, I think. Thank you very much.
Mark Thiessen, Nation. I teach in the seminary. Thank you very much for all of what you've said so far. I certainly resonated at a deep level, as I'm sure many would here, with your critique of empire and imperialism and all of that. And then I want to push you a bit more in relation to the ambiguities that you were beginning to name. That is to say, most of your references, for instance, are to the Tea Party. Barack Obama is nothing to get excited about these days for those of us who care about empire and imperialism and other matters. So Tea Party is too simple and resonates too easily with someone like me, that kind of critique, because there's a lot of critique to go around just in terms of empire and imperialism. But also empire and imperialism don't begin to name much of what we need to name. And again, you are beginning to do this, but the heaviest weight from everything I've heard from you so far, and in most of your writings that I've read, are on empire and imperialism and things like that. I think, for instance, of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, who are sometimes sort of held up as a model because they've adopted children from other cultures. But that's mostly their family life. What they do in their day job is acting. And in their acting, they happily portray money, sex, and power in ways that clearly collide with the biblical narrative. And that shapes most of us in our daily lives in terms of narratives, much more than what the state does. And so there's so much in our popular culture and in the media that shapes our narrative that it seems to me that we ought to pay attention to Alistair McIntyre, Stanley Hauerwas, and others, that we need thick narratives in relation to our communities that help us to have an alternative narrative to the one that is dominating us and shaping us repeatedly, which is certainly about empire, but it's also about the narratives we get from popular media.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. I think that the point of reference is not the state. The point of reference is the corporate culture, of which the media is a subset, and so I agree completely with. And I may need to use better vocabulary for communicating that. I do not think that military capitalism is primarily a governmental phenomenon. I think it's a phenomenon of corporate culture that controls the government, and indeed. Barack Obama's administration is largely led by Wall Street people. So I do think that he has some openings to do some things better than some people more to the right. But there shouldn't be any illusions that Barack Obama is completely committed to the same corporate structure. I agree with that. Thank you for that.
Steve Carpenter, resident in Harrisonburg, and a recent alumni of Eastern Mennonite Seminary. So this model of the empire and the Constantinian shift is familiar to me, and it's not particularly new, and it resonates. My question is, recently I've begun to see the connection between the corporate culture, the federal subsidies for high fructose corn syrup, and for an animal-based diet as part of this suppressing the people, and that the food that we eat makes us unhealthy, and so we put on statins, and the drug companies become rich because we're buying the statins rather than treating the underlying cause of the disease. We treat the symptoms, and I see that as part of this paradigm. Do you see that same connection?
I do indeed. When I started out last night of saying why I thought that food opened up questions of production, consumption, and distribution, and then I said it also opens up what do we do about the environment, by which I meant agribusiness and the whole chemical industry and all of that. So I think it's all there together, and I think that the alternative narrative that I want to try to talk about tonight is a narrative of the local and the particular, which would have to do with a very different kind of growth of food and all of that. So I agree with that completely. I don't have the reference points that you have, but I think we're singing the same song.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bryce Miller from Tucson, Arizona, and I want to give you liberty to say wait on this question, but I'm curious to hear a little bit more and how you see the role of confession in narrative. The role of confession.
A role of confession?
In narrative. Because, like it or not, we may not be the pointy end of the pyramid, but we have some fairly sharp angles. Furthermore, the narrative that we are charged with has been used and misused as part of the empire narrative for 2,000 years.
Yep.
And I think before we go too quickly into saying, well, that's not us.
Well, I agree.
We need to at least acknowledge that's who we have been.
I agree with that. And I think that
in my church tradition, the practice of confession tends to stay individualistic and moralistic, rather than collusion, to my great benefit, collusion in a system of death. That's what you're talking about, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think confession is not only an acknowledgement of that reality in my life, but it entails some resolve to depart from it. So in the old classic baptismal formula, I think there were three questions. Do you renounce Satan and all his works? Yes, of course. Why not?
Check, yes.
And I think most people in my church tradition think we're talking about sex. I renounce all that.
Sure.
But to renounce the corporate system of death, to really renounce that in my life is a very costly, serious business. I think we're talking about the same thing about that. Yes.
Yeah, I just feel like there is a necessary role to, as we preach gospel of otherness, to also acknowledge how deeply mired we are in,
I agree with
in
that,
the fiction of what is.
That's right. There's a reason that the old confession, which we would no longer use in a therapeutic age, that we said, and there is no health in us, for God's sake. Yeah. So we found nicer ways to say that now. But it is the truth of our life, so long as we have signed on for systems of death. Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Walter. Fiction versus fiction. Epistemological crisis. We're on the edge of a cliff, and I can feel my adrenaline going because you've taken us to where things really matter. Thank you. We've only begun this journey. Because we've only begun the journey, I want to highlight just a couple things. You already know this, but you'll note that all kinds of workshops and luncheons to continue exploring agenda in the thick of God and mammon. And if I could just ask for a show of hands, I'm curious for my own sake and for the sake of who we are as we're gathered here these next few days, could those of you who would identify yourselves as particularly here because interested in the business or management aspects of this conference raise your hands? We have at least a significant minority. And I wanted to pull that out and highlight it because clearly there's a lot of theological and biblical import to what we're wrestling with here. That really matters. We also would really like to hear from those of you who are in the thick of dealing with money day to day. I myself came to being a dean partly as a business owner. I'm thinking hard about that side of this. And I simply invite you to be thinking both in workshops and as we do talk back again tomorrow, feel free to raise some of your perspectives and engage that agenda, because I'd really like to hear how we work at some of this agenda when we are mired in capitalism or in the midst of capitalism and also experiencing the death-dealing potential of militaristic capitalism. Thank you all for being part of this event to this point. We are now going to move toward break time. And as Linda highlighted, we do invite you to use both the break areas, downstairs and upstairs, and have a wonderful time of fellowship and communion on the way to our rest of the day.